Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper on November 18th.
Sunday.
2018.
Yes, another big giant win.
Yeah, I was going to say, your voice is very perky, unusually perky.
You're on a roll.
And that's why.
It's
one of the few Sunday nights.
One of the few things that makes things happen.
That we can report a giant win.
And all our listeners will be the beneficiaries.
But we have other things going on. Shout out to our firstborn, Granger Abuhoff.
That's right. Birthday.
Yeah. Birthday on November 16th. He had kind of a horrendous day, I think, with a lot of traveling. He and his lovely fiancée, Nico, are up from Bogota for the holiday season.
Recuperating from their travels.
Recuperating in many ways. Also, happy birthday to Lisa Walsh.
Oh, really?
Our friend.
Really?
Who... recently celebrated.
Oh, good.
So there you have it. A festive time of year. We're looking forward to Thanksgiving and all that pie.
Right.
And a little bit late compared to the New York Times this week. The Wall Street Journal had a big pie article.
Pie is catching on.
But it's all about fancy pies. And, you know, who needs it? Anyway.
We were at the theater this week. Twice, and we saw a movie. It's a big cultural week for us, and that began.
We've been out and about.
Despite the weather. The holiday season's beginning. So, yes, despite the weather, it was a surprise snowstorm. But on Wednesday, we were at Classic Stage to see The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy.
And
it was interesting. It was, it's a funny thing. I liked it. Let me get that out quickly. But it's a Bertolt Brecht play. And the Times did a very prominent review, which was, generally positive. I think it was positive, by Ben Brantley. So that's all cool. But I found that the much more interesting review to me was in Vulture.com, the New York Magazine review. And the reason is, they were very attentive to the specific peculiarities of a Brecht play. And it was illuminating to me. And the review begins by saying, "Great Brecht productions are rare beasts." And I can see why that might be. The plays draw on vaudeville, I'm reading from the review now, physical comedy, old movies, and even older forms of storytelling that rely on the presence of narrators and choruses. And that was all true. This was different. It wasn't your standard narrative play. It's a play basically about the story of a guy named Arturo Uy, who is loosely based, frankly, on Adolf Hitler, and you can see it.
This takes place in Chicago,
and he is a gangster who corners the cauliflower market, is one way to describe what he's doing. And he's, a very heavy-handed, ham-handed, almost comic caricature, but still fearsome nevertheless. And he starts exerting his will on other folks. Again, a parallel to Hitler. It was written by Brecht in 1941 in a three-week period while he was fleeing Germany and he was in Finland. So you get the idea. It's not the most...
He scribbled it down.
It's not the most polished, complete, or even coherent in some respects in the way the action follows. It's not like a jewel box of a play. It's not that. But it is exactly as this review here suggests. It's by Sarah Holdren. That's why I thought it was worth quoting. It is this combination of these various art forms that conveys a pretty strong sense, but it all really turns on the main character, Arturo Uy, who has to be both fearsome on the one hand and in a sense, a big in life, comic, slapstick, and compelling at the same time. And he is played by Raul Esparza. And as this reviewer says, Raul Esparza is blisteringly good. And again, the quote, Esparza, and again, the reviewer singles out the production by John Doyle, Classic Stage artistic director. Under that direction and Esparza's performance, Arturo Uy is a sly, fearsome sideshow, a deceptively humble, hugely exciting piece of work. And I think that's fair. That was clearly the case. So you had this very stunning characterization against the backdrop of this sometimes confusing play, to be perfectly frank.
Well, as you pointed out, it was written in a particular context.
Yeah.
And if you're living within that time frame...
Right.
You're more familiar. All of this makes more sense. It's more topical. To some extent, it's like watching Saturday Night Live. 30 years later, 40 years later, 50 years later,
right.
You know, it's not, I mean, we have a vague idea of who the characters are because everyone has heard of Adolf Hitler.
Right.
I would think it resonated much more in the 1950s or something like that.
Surely. In the aftermath of Hitler, there's no question. And, you know, one thing the Times takes up is, well, does it resonate because people who feel very strongly about Trump are going to feel that same connection? The Times, who's more than apt to feel that connection if they have the opportunity, says, no, not really. That's their view. We're not going to get into that. But the way, again, going back to the New York Magazine, summing up, they say, look, it's Richard III meets Jimmy Cagney by way of the vaudeville circuit in the hands of Doyle and his actors. It's both rollicking and frightening. And I think that's sort of right. At the same time, I wouldn't mince words. It's a challenging play. You have to lend yourself to it. It takes a little bit to get going. I think that's fair. I think that's what Classic Stage is trying to do, is put on challenging work. It's not necessarily going to, they're not going to serve it up to you.
And once again, great staging.
Great staging. Very
that minimalist approach of John Doyle. And really, the intimacy of that small theater
also
affects the performance. And I think the performances were impressive, especially Esparza.
Right. No question. So if you're interested in serious theater to any degree, and serious theater in quotes, because there's a lot of humor in it too, it's certainly worth checking out. We also then, on Thursday, the intrepid Ms. Granger traveled into New York during the snowstorm.
The snowmageddon that happened. I was almost in that.
Yes.
I was trying to drive to the New Jersey Turnpike, and it looked like such a disaster. I turned around and took the train. So public transportation worked out for me, although it did not for many people that night.
Yeah.
But somehow, I got to New York. We went to see Mike Birbiglia, a comedian.
Yes.
Who has a writer. And we had mentioned him before a couple weeks ago, I believe. And since he was on our radar, since we were in New York, we thought we'd go and see his act, which we almost never do. We never go to
you're really touching on one of the issues there, and I don't really think it's a serious issue, or certainly not a problematic issue. Is it a comedy routine or is it a Broadway show, right? And
well, it's a one-man show.
It's a one-man show, but it's crafted in such a way that it lends itself to being characterized as a Broadway show. He sees it that way. His people see it that way. When he discusses it, he says, I'm playing a character. I'm playing this Mike Birbiglia character. I'm not really Mike Birbiglia, a person. And look, I don't think it's worth getting too lost down there. I mean, I will say this. I mean, they're sensitive to it in terms of the advertising. There's a huge one-page ad in the Times today. The ad is they take all these theater people whose credentials are unquestioned, and they all just have one word in front of them, in quotes, go. And who are those people? Lin-Manuel Miranda says, go. Nathan Lane says, go. Audra McDonald says, go. So that's the way they try to establish
their Well, I will class. Say this.
Yes.
I will say this. He really made me laugh.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I laugh a lot. You know, there's a lot of nervous laughter in my life. There's a lot of polite laughter. But he sincerely tickled my funny bone. And but what I will say is it's really the story of his transition into fatherhood.
Yeah, sure.
And so I think it resonates for anybody who's had kids.
Yes.
Whether you're in your 30s or whether you're, you know, in your 60s or whatever.
Yes.
But that's what makes it funny. So I highly recommend it. With that caveat,
ask you something. First of all, I think we should, just to finish the thought, I think in that ad, it could say Tamsin Granger, go. You would opt for that.
Oh, I would say go.
And I would say go also.
We enjoyed it a great deal. The whole time.
I thought it was wonderful.
But it was also thoughtful.
Oh,
and at certain points, it was very poignant.
That's a clear point. I mean, it's not just funny. It's thoughtful. It's thoughtful humor.
Yeah.
But you raise an interesting point. And look, I do think that we got to go to something with a lot of younger people in it, as it happens. Not that that's necessarily a plus, but the people move up the stairs more quickly. We have that. But beyond that, at the same time, not super young, because you do get a little more active if you have children. But let me ask you this question. I didn't ask you that. Obviously, he's telling it from the male point of view. Do you think one gets less out of it if you're a woman watching it, because he's explaining to have a child from the male point of view, even though he talks a great deal about his
wife?
No,
absolutely not. I think it was very interesting and compelling to hear a father thinking out loud about life.
Good.
With a child, before the child, after the child, et cetera.
Right. So. Yeah. No, it's excellent. I think people, if they have a chance,
better than hearing it from your husband, I'll say that.
Most things are. Yeah. That's for sure. So we really enjoyed that. And then, Unstoppable, we saw a movie yesterday.
Well, I dragged you to Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Oh, boy. Can you drag me? You drag me.
We went to that cute theater, the county theater, in Doylestown, PA.
Right.
And it's the story of Lee Israel, writer from second half of the 20th century.
Yeah, right? 1950s, 1960s.
Famous for some biographies.
Let's call it 1960s, 70s.
Including articles about Spencer Tracy. Mm-hmm. And she wrote a biography of Dorothy Kilgallen.
Oh, really?
So I feel like, I told you I felt I was familiar with her. Yeah. I'm pretty sure I read a biography
of Dorothy
in the 70s of Dorothy Kilgallen. So it might have been hers.
Okay. All right. So, and she's played by Melissa McCarthy, and it's gotten some publicity.
And it's gotten very good reviews of McCarthy's performance, because we always see her as kind of a clown.
Right.
Not that we even see her that much, but that's the part she usually plays. And here was pretty serious.
Right.
And not an attractive person.
Right.
And I don't mean that in a cosmetic way. I mean in a personality way, in a social way.
But that's
not somebody you warmed to.
But you see, to me, that's people saying, oh, she's showing range. She's being a serious person. I mean, I think Elizabeth McCarthy's always a disagreeable character. So I think...
I don't think that's true at all.
No, I think she's disagreeable, but she's funny. And here she's disagreeable, she's not funny.
No, she also plays very...
All right. I don't know enough about Melissa McCarthy. But in any event, so what did you think of the movie?
I thought the movie was a little slow, but it was interesting. I mean, it was caught somewhere between those more kind of artistic films and the Hollywood version of an artistic, compelling film.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But she was good. Her partner in crime... Richard Grant played that part. And this is all based on a book she wrote about her... She accidentally gets into forging letters by famous people.
Accidentally?
Well, she...
Not really.
She's trying to sell books about... she's writing books that nobody wants to read, nobody wants to publish, nobody wants to give her an advance for.
Right.
Like biography of Fanny Bryce.
Right.
And so she, one thing leads to another, and she develops this life of crime.
Yeah.
And she doesn't, I don't want to ruin it.
Well, okay. I agree with you a lot. I think, first of all, there's some very nice things about the film in terms of production values. So, beautifully shot.
New York City, Upper West Side, during the 1980s, 90s, during the 90s.
Right.
She walks through Central Park.
Right.
She goes to the Argosy bookstore.
Right. It's wonderful music. It's mostly kind of sung jazz music, a lot of Blossom Dearie. We're all into that. And so it has that going for it. And they take their time and lend an area of seriousness and real verisimilitude to the whole proceedings. I think her portrayal was of a character who's kind of flat. So she's kind of flat, and maybe that's range, but that's fine. Richard Grant is the one who brings life to the proceedings, because he's a flamboyant character who kind of lifts you up out of your seat a little bit, because you're getting pretty deep into the
scene. He's a guy who's willing to do anything, and that's why he ends up helping her.
Yeah. So, at the end of the day, not too much happens in the film, and perhaps a little bit more might have happened in the film to sort of draw you into it. But on the other hand, that, as you put it, that's what makes it something in between Hollywood and otherwise. Because sometimes in life, not that much happens. And, there wasn't much arc. She didn't really develop too much over the course of the film. And to the extent that they might have called a development, they were just trying to sort of, you know, shoehorn in a happy ending, right, which doesn't exist. So anyway,
she's a difficult person, but don't, you know.
And you know something? The movie's a difficult movie. So at the end of the day, we had this discussion and you said to me, is there anyone you would recommend it to? And I said, I can't think of anyone right away. And can you?
You know, not offhand. I mean, okay, it would be somebody, you know, you'd need to be interested in New York, interested in these different, the idea that these different characters would.
You'd need someone with a lot of patience. And I should say, the theater was full. It's not the first week they've had it there. And the audience seemed to enjoy it a great deal. So, there
right,
you go.
Potatoes.
Yes, we're just warming up to this article.
Fun article.
Yeah.
In the Wall Street Journal this weekend, in the Historically Speaking column by Amanda Foreman. Okay, and so she starts out by saying, by the way, okay, at the first Thanksgiving in 1621, there were no potatoes. There were no mashed potatoes. There were no potatoes of any kind because the potato doesn't come to the North America until 1719,
mm-hmm,
when Scottish-Irish immigrants bring it and start growing potatoes and making potatoes, okay? It has been, by then, for at least 200 years, in Europe, okay, brought to Europe by the Spanish conquerors of Peru in the 16th century, okay? But even in Europe, it wasn't terribly popular, you know? They ate potatoes in Spain, she says, but and the rest of Europe really thought of it as animal feed.
Mm.
And it's really Antoine Augustin Parmentier, who, while he's imprisoned by the Prussians in the Seven Years' War, is only given potatoes to eat. And he survives for, I think, a number of years. To his surprise, he stays relatively healthy on a diet of potatoes only. And then he begins to promote potatoes like crazy because he says, wow, this is clearly a solution to, you know, nutrition and famine for the world. He even gets Marie Antoinette to wear potato flowers in her hair.
Mm.
And maybe you've heard of Parmentier, which is basically roasted potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
As it's named after him, and he promotes potatoes like crazy. And, you know, Adam Smith is a fan.
Really?
Okay. He also sees it as a key to, you know, saving the world. And our buddy Thomas Jefferson at this time is an ambassador from the U.S. in France. He gets won over to the potato, and then he will be the person who introduces...
Thomas Jefferson.
He will introduce America to the French fry.
Ooh.
At a White House dinner.
Just when his reputation was beginning to slip.
In 1802.
All right, well, there you go. My thoughts of Jefferson are now turned.
So there you have it. By the way, it's interesting that in Peru in the 16th century, before the 16th century, they actually had a methodology for freeze-drying in a natural way, potatoes.
Right.
Okay. It's not till something like the 50s that the American government scientists are able to freeze-dry potatoes and make a, you know, for the instant mashed potatoes that we know today. And I also want to mention that the first potato ricer was invented in 1887.
All right, well.
Now, you know that we make mashed potatoes every Thanksgiving.
Yes.
With my grandmother's potato ricer.
The first ricer ever made.
Well, no, probably, but it's not too much younger, I will say. Yeah, it's early 20th century.
It is the scourge of Thanksgiving.
So it's there you have it. Lots of fun.
All right,
and
you know, it's nice. It's nice that you're jazzed up about this. You were clearly jazzed
up. I had no idea.
All right, listen, I'm glad you brought everybody's potato
knowledge up. You know, I'm going to go back to eating many more potatoes. You know, when you go to Peru, you eat a lot of potatoes.
Yeah, look.
And a lot of corn. They have a zillion kinds of corn there. But anyway, moving along.
Well, listen, you're jazzed up about that. One of the other things I know you're jazzed up all the time is about Terry Gross. fresh air. I don't know
she
how many times.
She is a goddess. She is a goddess.
Okay.
The goddess of interviews.
That's right. I don't know how many times I come home, you say, so I had an interesting thing on fresh air today.
From a totally uninteresting person, and somehow Terry makes it interesting.
Yes, her show is Fresh Air, and she does these interviews with folks. And she has, she's the queen of what I'll call, NPR interviews. And
I would say goddess.
Goddess, queen, whatever. So the Times, in a very helpful way, has an article called A Masterclass in the Fine Art of Conversation. They do an interview with Terry Gross about how is it that you can talk to people and in the same engaging manner or something approaching what Terry Gross manages, and how does she draw people out? And I will say, I've heard her interviews. And
no matter what they are, politician,
she does
artist,
pretty well. Not 100%.
Performer.
Not 100%. But she does very well and sort of drawing people out and having a real conversation in what are, you know, fairly artificial circumstances. So I give her credit for that. She's very good. But I was interested in the article.
In her advice.
Because, yes, in her advice, in her secrets. And there is something here. This is quite interesting. And it's this. She says, the only icebreaker you'll ever need is four words. And you know what those four words are? Those four words are, tell me about yourself. And think about that. And we're not talking about in having a radio show. We're talking about talking to people or something like it. I'm thinking about interviewing people. I do a lot of interviews
at
work.
She actually goes on to that. And she also gives the flip side of some advice about how to respond as the interviewee.
Yeah, all right. But we'll get to that in a second. But the idea is the notion of saying the simple power of saying someone very directly, tell me about yourself. And that may not be the easiest. That may be too blank a slate to sort of present at a cocktail party.
I would have thought that that's too big a question for a lot of people. What should I say?
I don't think those are the four words. But what I'm saying is there are variations on that theme. Okay?
Okay.
That you can get to someone and you're just saying, you're communicating to that person in sometimes implicitly is, tell me something. Tell me something about you. I'm interested. I'm interested in you. I'm interested in hearing about you. And that is powerful, I believe. And I think most people take that invitation. They may not take it if you shove it down their throats because you're saying, I want to hear in three sentences a summary of your life. That's crazy. But just to indicate that level of interest in somebody and interested in whatever they choose to say about themselves, even if it's not a summary of their entire lives, I think is an interesting way of communicating. And I can tell you when I interview, and I interview a lot of students who are looking for, you know, who interview for jobs at the law firm, I can't say, tell me about yourself, because they'd have a heart attack. But I can, after a few questions, in a roundabout way, say, that's interesting. How'd you come to that decision? Why did you decide to do this?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what you were thinking at that time. What's your take on this, or where you are, or how that went, you know? Very open-ended questions, and that's when you learn about people. And so I think she's entirely right about that. Her other advice is, I think, useful too. You know, you have to be curious about people to get, yes, there's no question. And she seems genuinely curious about people. Be funny if you can, yes, but if you can't, you can't. So that's a little tricky.
Be funny in the sense that, you know, do something to engage them.
Yes.
So that they're awake and paying attention.
But in any event, so you're
answering.
But you were saying in terms of an interviewee, what was your point?
She was also pointing out that, one of your problems in an interviewee may be having to talk about things you don't want to talk about.
Right.
And so she gives some tips about how to say no.
Right.
But I think she also gives tips about how to push somebody to say, yes, I will tell you this. She plays both sides there in giving some advice.
Well, I do remember what I remember about the article when she says how to, you know, pushing back. When she says be direct, say something. I'm not comfortable talking about that, or I'd rather not get into that because I don't want to, you know, talk about another person, or I'm still processing that. And but in terms of what is she suggesting in terms of pushing back? Yet again, as the question, I'm not sure I really got that. I mean, I guess she's just persistent.
Yes, mainly it's persistence.
But the nice about it, but it's in a very direct way. They're not like fussing, saying, oh, you know, you're not being a good interviewer. They're just saying, you know, I want to talk about this. Perhaps I don't want to talk about this for this reason. And the response is, well, maybe we don't have to get into that aspect of it. I'm interested in this. But it's very directly.
I think it can be much more successful to simply, to very simply say you're not going to talk about something, as opposed to ramble on confusedly about something you don't want to talk about.
Right, I agree. And it creates the wrong impression. In any event, I thought it was interviewing. I think Tell Me About Yourself Again, not in those four words entirely, but is a very powerful thing. So before we get onto something else, I just want to mention quickly that even because I'm always identified as being incorrect about all my sports predictions, I was correct when at the beginning of the season I said, watch this guy, Shohei Ohtani, Japanese pitcher / outfielder being signed in the American League by the Angels. That's the guy who's going to be a big sensation. He'll be Rookie of the Year. And 2 days ago, he was voted Rookie of the Year. And he was voted Rookie of the Year, notwithstanding he had a bad injury and he had to stop his pitching. He just played the outfield for the last few months. And yet he had 22 home runs. 22 home runs, and he had a 4-3 record as a pitcher. It's crazy that he did that.
It is crazy.
And so I was right about that.
Well, you know, this is not really helping us, Dan. Now it's getting confusing. We had this thing where you were always wrong, we could count on that.
All right.
And we could make money on that, maybe. And now sometimes you're wrong, sometimes you're right.
This is getting
confusing.
Okay, here's something I'm right about. Here's something I'm right about, which is the, quote something in the Wall Street Journal about, Aston Martins, okay? Aston Martins. We have at least one listener who I know.
We have one aficionado of the Aston Martin.
Okay, and then the article begins in very excited tones that are going to appeal to just that listener and others too, in which the writer, Matthew Kitchen in the Journal, says he's always dreamed of having a project in the garage. His friends are with him tinkering in the car. And, it's a classic car. He says, this weekend I more or less achieved my fantasy, putting the final touches on an automotive classic I've lusted after for 30 years, James Bond's Aston Martin DB5, debuting in 64's Goldfinger, the definitive 007 car, complete with radar tracker, fog lights, revolving license plates, etc. The only problem being, my Aston Martin was made of Legos. Legos. He didn't have a real car in his garage. He bought a Lego kit.
Big is it? Is it like life size?
They don't give the exact, let's see, scale 1 to 8. It's 1/8 the size of a car.
But it really functions?
No.
Oh, but you said it had revolving...
yes, it has everything. It has everything, but it just doesn't function. It doesn't drive.
Okay.
It has...
But it revolves.
It even has a little phone in the car.
Okay, but the phone doesn't work.
Well, you can pull it out, but that doesn't work.
All right.
It's made of... 1,295 Lego pieces in more than 20 bags. It took him...
20 bags?
20 bags of plastic pieces.
And how much does it cost, does the article say?
I think it's something like $60-some-odd.
$60?
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Or maybe even a little more, actually.
That's tremendously affordable.
It took him 15-odd hours to build it.
I smell Christmas gifts.
Oh, thank you. And it took him 15...
Not you, dummy.
It took him 15-odd hours to build it. But the point of the article is, he loved it. He loved it.
Boy doesn't love building Legos?
He's not a boy. He's an adult. He is sort of, I guess.
Yeah.
He said, on two different nights, I looked up to see the clock winding closer to 2 a.m., but I didn't stop. Each small step took only a handful of minutes. So why not complete a few more before bed? It's like you doing crossword puzzles, really, Tamsin. It's a little bit
that. No. Jigsaw puzzle is my thing.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jigsaw puzzles, of course. He says he when he put in the pieces, he reached a meditative, immersive high, what they call flow. That's when you're most creative. Too easy, you get bored. Too complicated, you get stressed and frustrated and quit. So you can identify with this, right?
Yeah, I think everybody needs some kind of, that's what a good hobby can do for you.
Right.
All right.
Right, but you get that, you get into it and you don't want to quit and you're kind of drawn into it, you're challenged.
Yeah, it can be the jigsaw puzzle, but it could also be the gardening, the working in the garden.
We're having a puzzle conversation.
It will be engaging. You need something engaging like that.
But the pressing point for him was when he finished the car.
Yeah.
And then he finished it and he was depressed.
That is the upsetting part. Right. If you're doing a project that you really love.
Right.
It's like reading a book that you really love.
Yes.
And then it comes to the end.
He said to himself,
what do you do now?
What are you going to do? He's just going to put it on the shelf. It looks like something. He played with it for 8 seconds.
But that's not what you love.
And then
love
it's going to gather
it.
Dust.
Yeah, that's not what you and love then, about it. It's the doing.
He's got to buy another Lego kit. And the Lego guy he interviewed says, well, that's the business they're in. Go buy yourself another Lego kit. That's how they hook you. So in any event, that's keep your eye out for that. That's a Christmas present for a lot of people, I think.
As Wall Street Journal has an article about a fun little book, a review of a fun little book, Little Dancer, Aged 14, by Camille Lorenz. And the review is by Moira Hodgson. It's the story of the Little Dancer sculpture by Degas.
Right.
Edgar Degas, that when it was first displayed in 1881, we love it. We love it. There are many, many reproductions. People are always mentioning it. Even my yoga teacher now and then is mentioning, you know, don't we look like the Little Dancer or whatever.
You've assured me it's a world-famous sculpture.
It's quite popular.
Okay.
All his ballet sculptures are quite popular. But when this first went on display in Paris in 1881, people thought it was awful. They thought she was ugly, looked like a criminal, a monster, a bestial effrontery. Sickly, grayish face, old and drawn before its time. And you should understand that when we see this sculpture, it's in bronze. Yeah. Okay, Degas takes up sculpting and other media like pastel in his sort of older age. As he's moving into the 1880s, because he's losing his sight. And so it's easy to manipulate wax into a sculpture than to have the eyesight to do precise painting.
Right.
So this sculpture originally was done in wax with real clothes, and I've always heard real hair.
Right.
And then all these sculptures are found in his apartment / studio when he dies. And then they are then cast into bronze.
Right.
But he never saw them in bronze.
See, that's amazing.
He never saw them cast into bronze or even sought to have them cast during his lifetime.
So this becomes a world-famous sculpture, but it didn't exist in that way while the artist was alive.
And it also was not at all revered in its time.
Oh.
Okay, because people were into what's called physiognomy. Like, you can look at somebody's face and it has features that tell you that person is evil or that person might be a murderer, okay? So this, people felt they could see. Young ballet dancers had a tough time during this period. She was a ballet, the person who he sculpted was a young dancer for the Paris Opera who made money on the side by posing for artists. These girls worked tremendous hours. They had tough lives. They made almost no money and were often forced into or tricked into prostitution, etc. So not a happy story, not a happy life. But the things that are interesting to me are that A, the people in the time saw this artwork completely differently than we see it. You know, we look at things with our 20th, 21st century eyes, and we invent a whole different context for this adorable, innocent young girl and her beauty. So that's, anyway, interesting book, Little Dancer, Age 14, by Camille Lorenz, translated into English, and gives a little bit of a fuller picture of art by Degas.
Okay, well, that's interesting. So we have a few obituaries, just two or three, to close it out. And the first one has to do with Storm King, which is a sculpture garden that you and I have been to.
Yeah, I think we've mentioned a couple times before. It's in Mountainville, New York, the Storm King Art Center. And it's fantastic.
Yeah, I agree with that.
It's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable.
It's 500 acres in the beautiful rolling hills of the Hudson River Valley and with enormous modern sculpture, contemporary sculpture, set out in various locations. And the one time we were there, it was like 98 degrees and sunny and unbearable.
It was.
We still loved it. And we had a wonderful time.
It was too hot.
Dripping with sweat.
Yeah, all right.
Anyway.
It is unbelievable.
The co-founder of this, H. Peter Stern, passed away at age 90. He started this with his father-in-law, who was his business partner as well. His father-in-law, Ralph Ogden, had a manufacturing business of, what would you call it, metal fasteners. And but he was a great collector. He started collecting stuff. He wanted to start some kind of museum and bought a chateau in the Hudson River Valley, and somehow got from having the chateau to wanting to have big sculpture outside, and they bought 500 acres of land in 1960. And it says that the turning point was seeing the sculptures of David Smith and being at his property in the Adirondacks, where he had his enormous works out in...
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, it's almost hard to get across how weird this is. Huge sculptures upon sculptures upon sculptures outside across a huge landscape.
It's and
crazy.
It's engaging.
It's
you
insane.
Don't have to know anything about modern art or the artists or anything. It's just fabulous. And the wonderful sort of walkways to ramble through all this property.
Right.
It was a tremendous idea, and I hope it is always there. Late in life, Mr. Stern also took up cooking and performing mime.
Mm.
So he actually starts out not terribly interested in the art.
Yeah.
And he's the administrative side of the team. His father-in-law is the great collector. And then he slowly gets more and more into it and gets very involved also in the preservation of great works of art.
Well, it's a big old bit.
Buildings.
I mean, it's a pretty amazing sight. It's pretty amazing. All right, so Stan Lee died this week. I mean, I hesitate to say anything about Stan Lee. I think it's fair to say that the Stan Lee's passing received more coverage in terms of obituaries than any figure of recent memory. If you came from another planet, you would decide the most important person to have lived on the Earth over the last 50 years was Stan Lee.
I was astonished. It was two full pages in the New York
Times.
And
that was just the beginning. And but they had a
Even
follow-up.
Mary Tyler Moore didn't get that.
No, that's true. And she was big. There was follow-up with that. There were at least two different sets of articles in the Wall Street Journal. And listen, I read the Marvel comics. I liked them. And Stan Lee had a lot to do with that. He had nothing to do with the movies, really. And I think that's to his credit, honestly. Although when the Times identifies Marvel as being, you know, one of the principal cultural phenomena of the last 25 years, they are talking about the movies. And that is kind of a depressing thought if that's a principal cultural phenomenon. But maybe it is. But in any event, so Stan Lee was, a creative guy. And he did have the idea of making comic characters that were not like Superman, but were imperfect, who were in family situations, who were in difficult relationships. And his heroes acted out of those circumstances. So his idea was, let's have the Fantastic Four. It's four people, including, a brother-sister combination that don't get along all the time, a marriage which had its ups and downs, a guy who had a bad experience. In terms of, thinking about how people get superpowers and the legends that arrive from that, I think as my friend Harry Zerlin pointed out, Stan Lee had one thought in that connection, one only, and that was radioactivity. Stan Lee's characters all got powers from radioactivity. As Harry's told me, if you're ever wondering if the characters weren't invented by Stan Lee, ask how they got their powers. So Spider-Man bit by a radioactive spider. The Fantastic Four exposed to radioactivity. The Hulk, radioactivity. There you go. I mean, it's different than Krypton. It's different than Superman. But it tells you a little bit about how radioactivity was described. It was thought of in the 60s. It was kind of this magical, strange thing, and that unlocked it for Stan. So his greatest strength was not in terms of variety or creativity with respect to superpowers, But at least he lit on to that. So, but what's interesting is that, of course, he created a great deal of villains, too, and that's what makes it so compelling. But I can't credit the... there's someone else who passed this week who actually created a greater villain than Stanley ever created. And didn't really get that much notice. And there's a fellow named Douglas Rain, who was an actor and a classical actor for many years and was with the Stratford Festival in Ontario. He was Canadian. He had a great classical background. But what Rain was famous for is Rain was the voice of Hal in 2001.
Oh, really?
Yes. And there is a little bit of a cult appreciation for the voice of Hal. And you'll remember that voice, Tamsin. It's a very flat voice saying things like, "I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that."
So right. Flat that it is creepy.
Yes, it is terribly creepy. And the story of how this came about is this. Of course, this is a Stanley Kubrick film. And he shoots the whole film. And he knows he wants some kind of disembodied voice only almost for Hal, but he can't quite get it. So he has Martin Balsam, who you remember was a great character actor, record it.
Yeah, doesn't work.
He doesn't feel it's right. He has an English actor record it. He has a lot of people record it. He can't get it right. He watches a small documentary, and it happens to have a narration by this fellow, Douglas Rain. He's not even looking at the time. He's just watching the documentary. And he listens to that voice. He says, "That's the guy. That's the guy. Find him. Find him." And they get Douglas Rain. And he pulls him into a studio. And he tells him about the character. The film's long shot. The film's done.
Yeah.
And he says to Rain, "Look, here's basically kind of who you are or what you are. And here's what you're doing. And let's just record all the lines." He says, "Really?" He said, "I'd like to get into the character." I said, "No, we're not doing that. We've just got a day and a half. Just read the lines." And
Just start reading.
And that's what they used. They used
first time
what?
Through?
Yeah. Well, they might have some back and forth, but in a day and a half, they did it. And he's not responding to anybody. They didn't bring any actors in. Nothing. That's what they used. They asked Rain about it, the experience. He didn't enjoy the experience because it's not a creative experience for him.
Yeah.
Right? And matter of fact, he never went and saw the movie.
Okay.
And yet, the American Film Institute recently published a list of the 50 greatest villains of all time in the movies. Hal was number 13.
Oh, my goodness.
And this guy had no idea what he was reading. Right? So there you have it. You never know where these creative forces come from. Douglas Rain, the great villain Hal, passing at the age of 90. Right up there was Stan Lee. So that's all we have.
Yeah, I would stay longer, but I got to make pie.
Yeah. That's a good idea.
This is Tamsin Granger.
And Dan Abuhoff.
Tamsin and Dan read the paper. See you next week.
Yes.